at the third principle now of the 12. Obtain a yield. You can't work on an empty stomach. And when we're looking at the icon, what we're seeing is a vegetable, root vegetable, with a bite out of it. And it's reminding us that firstly, the air, the sun there has translated, that plant has translated the energy of the sun into a stored form of energy, catch and store energy. And then now we need to tap into that energy to sustain ourselves. It's going to be our first sort of considerations is this sort of transition from the catch and store, which is part of our process, and then obviously the obtaining the yields, which is obviously how we make a living, how we feed ourselves, how we feed our families. I'm going to take you to Zimbabwe, and that's why we started off. That was a bit of music from the great Thomas Mapfumo, obviously the sort of legendary singer from Zimbabwe, and also that feel of that rhythm somehow just transports me. So you might notice I have posted a couple of videos on the lesson 5 page. Now, if you have the bandwidth, you're able to, I encourage you to watch Land Restoration in Zimbabwe and also Vetiver, a green technology for the 21st century. pause the sound here and visit those videos. If you don't have the ability to stream video, don't worry, I will be touching on all of the main points made in the video in the PDF slideshow, which I ask you to download now. Okay, I welcome you to Chimani Money, using permaculture to build a landscape. This is a deep and personal story, actually, and I'll put a link towards the end of this to the article where most of this material came. Chimani Money is on the eastern edge of Zimbabwe, where it borders Mozambique. And it's interestingly, I mean, for me anyway, it's the place where I encountered permaculture when I became the caretaker manager of a small farm there in 1991. And that was a really pivotal changing part of my life. And it's how I sort of got what drew me into the permaculture world. Anyway, that aside, moving to slide one. Obtaining yields. The first strategy, the first thing that you're seeing there is some raised beds on quite a steep slope. That's in Wales, in the UK, where we're working. And we also recognise that we're all subject to the same forces that, you know, the universal. So what we know is that when we garden, we get long, cold, wet periods, is the ground gets really muddy and compacted and becomes very, very hard to work there. So what we've done is we've built contour paths and we've put wood chip and old organic matter on there, which eventually will feed the soils underneath our raised beds. Now, we've built wooden box raised beds because we had a bit of budget, we had a bit of money to spend, and because we wanted it to look really good, because it's actually in a very public place behind the institute in Llanfyllin, which is where the town council meets and other kind of community things go on there. So we're trying to influence and change the thinking of our community to allow us to kind of grow food everywhere. And one of the things that people worry about here in the UK is that things might look messy and not get done properly. So we're really trying to make the effort. But I'm also showing you this, saying that we're working with the same principles here. The catch and store energy, think about how the water erodes the landscape, think about how we can trap it in the system as long as we can. Okay, so this beautiful image of the mask in the face in Zimbabwe. This used to be the biggest selling tourist T-shirt design for in years ago. And it's designed by a South African artist called Kevin Huff. He lived most of his life in Zimbabwe. Sadly passed away now. It was meeting Kevin, really, that changed the course of my life. He lived in Chimani Money. And through a sort of chance meeting, I was, through him, connected to many of the people involved in permaculture in that region, which turns out to have been a pioneering region for permaculture anywhere in the world. And I just kind of turned up by accident. So, you know, that's sometimes how life works. Synchronicity is important. You know, that just a chance. So the first slide that we're looking at here of slide 4 is a landscape, a very typical kind of landscape that you might see in that part of Zimbabwe. It's very steep. It's a district is called Chikukwa, And let's, for the purpose of telling a story, bringing this alive, let's I'm going to bring you into this photo was taken in about 1990, about 1990 or 91, about the time when I first arrived there and met some of the people involved. Interestingly, there was one European couple living in that whole valley, about seven or eight clans of the Chukwukwa clan, seven, eight, nine, 10,000 people living there. There was one white German family, a couple who were teachers, and who we got to meet. They were friends through our Kevin, our friend Kevin, and so on and so forth. So here's the story. We look, think about what we said in the previous slideshow about that convex, concave landscape. Think about where the settlement line is on that edge, where the convex switches to concave. And what I told you about how water seeps into the ground in the high up in the hills, and then how slowly that percolates through the soils down, nourishing the whole landscape. Well, the beginning of this story is this household here on the left is, you know, one day they went down the hill a little bit to their well, and their well was dry. This is a community region that is several miles, hours of dirt road before you get to sort of the next, you know, to develop settlements, completely running on boreholes and trapped, you know, rainwater. So that's a problem. Also, we're looking at this landscape is, to me, it looks really eroded. It looks tired. It looks like I'm seeing bare soil everywhere. It's been grazed too much, too many cows. Probably unregulated, uncontrolled grazing. You can see footpaths, whether they're people or animals, but snaking all over the landscape, looking increasingly dusty and dried out. I'm not seeing many trees, and seeing some sort of shrubs on the what look like very steep slopes. And what's the beginning of what's starting to happen then? They're starting to get gully erosion really badly. Is seasonal heavy rains are just opening up channels, go straight downhill, and really causing massive problems. As the landscape dries out, people are forced to kind of graze it harder and be more ruthless in the way they manage it. And really, this is the beginning of the end, really, for a whole landscape and potentially for the whole Chikukwa clan community. They were starting to experience malnutrition for the first time, really food insecurity, and it was a net out migration. Young people, fit, young, strong, you know, people who'd achieved an education were leaving the area. This is how it was at that time. A small, determined group of people. We go to slide the next slide, number five. A small, determined group of people, you know, can change the world. This is what we taught, this is what we've learned, this is what we've experienced. And what happened was, I think they call it Selk permaculture. I need to check, but anyway, they started their own very, very small project, and I think it was a nucleus of four or five people at the beginning. And they looked at the wider landscape and issues, and they reached out to the Fambidzinai Permaculture Training Center in Harare for some support and some ideas and some thought about how can they save this precious, precious landscape. And they were told to dig swales, to measure contours. They used an A-frame, a very simple tool, which we'll look at later, to find level ground. And they were told to take their hose and to dig a ditch along the contour and to build a bank on the lower side. And the later plan then would be to plant into that bank with plants that were deep-rooted and plants that would help stabilize the landscape and reduce the erosion and increase infiltration of rainwater. They went with they used vetiver grasses, and that's something else which we will expand on in this lecture. So when you're looking at this slide, what you're seeing is these lines across the landscape going for literally miles. It's a huge amount of work, and what happened was, you know, a lot of it had to be done in the dry season when there wasn't so much work else to do. So it was very hot, and you know, it was hard work, and only a few people were really engaged in this because most people saw it as a fairly thankless task that wasn't going to produce any yields, you know, anytime soon. So they started doing it. This little small band of people started digging their swales, making their measurements, and each day, you know, one or two people more would come along, hanging around, wondering what they were doing, and slowly getting enticed into and drawn into being part of this group. They built their they created their own work songs about the work that they were doing, celebrating the swales, the possibility of water retention, and soil building. And again, this was a very, very important way to inform other people, community members who perhaps didn't understand what they were doing, to draw them in, to build a set, wider sense of understanding. And this is one of the real values of permaculture, is in its ability to help us build consensus and make long-term plans. So this built work built on itself, and it worked on itself. And as the project grew, they become much more skillful and adept at educating people and drawing them into the project as well. So that was a big part of their learning, was learning how to do this, and then also how to communicate what they were doing in a way in which other people felt interested, included, and involved. So we just jump to the next slide now, and we see this is the figure 7.23 is an illustration out of Bill Mollison's Permaculture Designer's Handbook. And that's the original kind of swale idea. And we can see, look, there's the ditch, there's the bank on the lower slope. You can see that dotted line is showing you where the surface was before. And we've got trees planted, we've got shrubs and different things planted on either side to help stabilize that system. And what it's trying to show is the water in the swale is not supposed to flow. It's supposed to be absolutely level. So it'll rise and fill the swale and then slowly, slowly percolate, infiltrate, seep, soak into the ground. And once you've got the water into the soil, you've started to change the whole nature of the thing. You're hydrating your landscape now, and you're not exposing yourself. You're greatly reducing the risk of erosion. So even though these features seem insignificant and they seem small, their impact can be really long-term and lasting. Now, the other half of this slide, I just put this picture in because I wanted you just to think more, to start to visualize, look at plants, not just the part above ground, but the part of below ground. And there are many interesting long-term plants that grow in quite harsh environments. And this is from the US prairies. And their long-term survival is because they have such vast root systems. They're able to access water and nutrients from deep, deep down, and build fertility in long-term cycles. So that's the kind of niche that the vetiver grass comes from. It's that kind of a plant. So if we just jump to the next slide, we're having a little look at vetiver. Now, what's great about it, it comes from the Himalayas originally, and it's a marsh plant. It can tolerate actually even being underwater for quite some days. So it's a very strong plant. It's very tolerant in damaged soils, and it's very drought and fire resistant. And really, yeah, the really, really key point as well is it stacks away tons and tons of carbon into the ground, which builds you long-term fertility. So it's a tough, spiny grass with a vast root system. The grasses can be cut, they can be ground, and they can be fermented, and be used for animal feed, they can be used for mulch, and they can be used for protecting and reconditioning soils. The grasses can be used for thatching. You can use them even as some kind of a biofuel for cooking. But what's really interesting about, and oh yeah, I've seen people doing weaving and all sorts of different things from it. So here, earlier on, we talked about how an element in a design system needs to perform multiple functions. Well, hello, vetiver. Welcome to, you're welcome to my world. So what's really great is we can stabilize landscapes, we can feed our animals, and we can build mulch for our crops. But also is we can extract the essential oil, which is the base ingredient of just about 70% of perfumes around the world. It's valuable. So it gives us options. Anyway, I'm moving on, and we're now jumping into one of the farms. We're now a few years down the timeline, and let's give him a name. Let's call him Mr. Chisango. And he would now describe himself as a permaculture farmer. In fact, some research that was done in Chikukwe about 12 years into the project revealed that about 70% of the farmers in the whole wider valley would call themselves specifically permaculture farmers. I think they've now reached something like 40,000 families, and this is now starting to become one of the most successful and biggest permaculture projects of anywhere in the world. And it's in Africa, and it's in Zimbabwe, and it's not funded by governments, and it's not part of some big aid program. It's been self-generated. So let's have a little look around Mr. Chisango's farm. What we're seeing is, you know, and I'm kind of second guessing. I have visited this place, but I wasn't there for, you know, the latter stages of the projects. But I see the patterns. You can see his vetiver swale right there. And you can see how he's obviously been continuously cropping that, feeding that to his goats. One of the rules that they established very early on in the Chikukwe project was that all goats must be tethered. And if they're not tethered, you can sort of take it home and milk it. And they weren't going to graze cows up on the upper slopes of the mountains anymore to allow them to for the forestation to get established. So these are very important rules. So people had to change long-term established behaviours, including how they manage their livestock. But there's an advantage. If you've got your livestock much closer to the house, you can then process the manure. They're all learning how to make compost manure, and to build the soil fertility and build the soil carbon. And I'm seeing behind him loads of shrubs, a whole line, again, on contour of shrubs, of small multi-stemmed plants, tough woody plants. I'm imagining a lot of those would be nitrogen-fixing shrubs, things that, again, build soil but produce edible seeds, edible leaves. There's many plants in that category: Lucina, Calliandra, just to name a couple. But there's many more. Depending on what we want the landscape to do for us, and then also is looking behind. So he's stabilising the landscape, building fertility, creating a range of different yields, all of which go back to support the function of stopping the erosion and building fertility. Now let's look around his house. You can see his house in the background. And I'm seeing, I think, banana trees, mango, avocado, guava. I mean, from memory, I remember seeing an enormous variety of stuff being grown. And again, this is kind of a departure from what these people would have been used to, probably more orientated towards cattle and so forth. And they've still got some cattle. But instead, they've diversified. They're creating many different yields now from their landscape, some which can be harvested immediately and some which maybe can take several years before they establish, because you can actually propagate and sell the vetiver. You can use the yields from the vetiver, and you can say you can develop make essential oil from it. But all of that is helping develop and support your farming methods. So if we go to the next slide, and this is the final slide in this sequence, and just remember how dry and eroded and really near to collapse that landscape looked in the first slide. Now what we're looking at is the same place, but instead we look to the top of the mountain, top of that slope, it's all forested. That means it's breaking the heavy rainfall up, it's helping it soak into the ground, and there's whole yields there now of timber products, which people can access. There's lots and lots of small gardens, and you can just see rows upon rows of trees and shrubs and vetiver on contour. When everybody starts doing this, you're now starting to stabilize the whole landscape. I think, you know, there's certain advantages that the people in Chikukwe had, or let's say sort of things that they turned to their advantage. Because they were remote, they couldn't look outside, and without really very much money for investment, they couldn't really look outside for, you know, for resources. Maybe information, knowledge, and a little bit of investment possibly. But they've been kind of forced to propagate the plants themselves, work with the landscape themselves, and to work with, you know, local and natural resources, what's exactly there already. I see this as a wonderful achievement, and Only really the beginning of an amazing journey that Chukwuka Valley is on. They've started to open training centers and to host visitors. And now, you know, people are coming from all over Zimbabwe to visit them. Maybe people will be coming from all over Africa or even over from the rest of the world to see what's possible when a whole community comes together, coordinates the action, and sticks to the same set of patterns.
Timothy.